Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. Since 1988, Whitetail Institute has been perfecting annual and perennial seed products specifically for hunters who plant food plots. Their seeds have been engineered to be palatable, high in protein, and extremely attractive to deer. Whether you live in the Deep South or Midwest farm country, they have products that will help you grow your best food plot yet. For more information about their seeds and their blends, visit whitetailinstitute.com. Enter the discount code SE15 for 15% off.
We're leaving today and entering a world of Mickey Mouse waving, princess meeting and greeting, lightsaber clashing, the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror dropping, Banshee flying, Space Mountain launching, galaxy rewinding, what is the point of galaxy rewinding, fireworks igniting, world of other worlds, for whatever you love. Infinite worlds await at the most magical place on Earth, Walt Disney World Resort.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need, from athletic stuff, like a full court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace, to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist! Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe white-tailed deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
Hi, I'm John Teeter, Whitetail Landscapes. This is Maximize Your Hunt. Welcome back, everybody. Hopefully, everybody's doing well. I am actually working on reports. I will be working on a pretty large project here through the month of November, trying to get that completed before the start of my next client season. Let's see. Hunting season is upon us or on us at this point, and everyone's, I'm sure, quite busy. You're in the mindset of, you know, what do I need to do? I need to execute. You know, what are the technical details? What are the things that I need to think about when I'm starting to plan out my next few days or weeks, what have you, to be successful? So part of this technical series is taking, you know, some of the best hunters, you know, either in my areas or across the US, and trying to dig a little bit further to figure out, you know, how they approach things. What are their tactics and strategies that allow them to be successful year in, year out, or just have the awareness factors that they have that that maybe you can learn from and apply to your setting. So I have Eric Hansen back. He's been on the podcast multiple times. I thought we did a great podcast. I don't know how long ago it was with box blinds. I thought he did an excellent job kind of detailing, you know, his use of box blinds and the importance of them, you know, in a hunting scenario. So I just recall that as being a nice conversation we both had. So let me get him on the line. Eric, how are you been?
Great. How are you?
Good. Good. I'm happy to be relaxing today. I don't have too much going on. Although I did move some cameras around this morning. So, I was using the rain to my advantage and able to get one or two cameras in there, and we needed the rain. So that's always helpful.
Yeah. I was going to say using the rain to your advantage has not been something we could say all for the last 3 months.
Yeah. I mean, I think on
some, although,
go ahead.
Yeah. Although we may be able to use it to our advantage now, if you know what I'm saying, the lack of rain, I think it's a big deal. It's a big deal, and maybe not necessarily like a water source. It's kind of some other things that I'm seeing.
Well, here's one thing that I noticed last night. I went for a bike ride, stretched my legs a little bit, and I'm driving around a bunch of our fields where the farmer has not done its final cut on the alfalfa fields, and they are lush and plentiful. Even without the rain, those fields seem to be just very temperate and doing an excellent job of growing still. So that's one thing to note when you have, you know, droughty conditions, so to speak. Alfalfa has a tendency to do pretty well in those conditions. So that's just one thing I'm noticing in my particular area.
Very deep roots, you know, that's alfalfa. They prefer the dry over the wet, but you're right. And what I'm seeing here, like on my farm in particular, after we harvest our wheat crop, we go in with just a red clover mix. But I mean, I've got, you know, 300 acres of it. And it's right now, it's like lush and green. And like it is in my area, the number one food source, by not without even a doubt. It's crazy. Even more than alfalfa. In my area, the alfalfa has just been cut recently, so it's basically nothing. But man, the clover is shining for sure. One other thing that's unique to this year too, the food source also tied into this green. I had a camera in a creek bottom, and the creek actually dried up, but for whatever reason, shaded area, deer were eating it was just grass, but it was one of the only things in that entire area that was green and had the moisture, and they're feeding on it. Normally that would be irrelevant, but not this year.
Interesting. Yeah, that's really interesting. What else did you notice throughout the summer months that might change your tactics going into mid-October, you know, the rut periods? Are deer shifting later? What are some of the things that you've seen just in your particular area that you're hunting?
I don't know if they've shifted later. That's kind of, I find that's individual to the deer. I'd definitely say they're not shifting sooner. So if anything, it's either, you know, normal or maybe a little late. I mean, I guess for me around here, we had a really good spawning season for whatever reason. I think it was a late harvest of the hay because of the wet spring. I think that got a few extra through from the hay choppers. And for me, like going into this early October and stuff, mid-October, we need to shoot those on my properties. We I don't know if you know, you see the videos we do with Just Hunt Club with the Doe Fest. I mean, we kill those every year, but like, man, there's little pockets of them, you know, they'll be in spots that they don't get hunted. And then all of a sudden, like this time of year, they're going to those green food sources more. They're like just drawn to them. So like, I think it just makes the numbers, it just kind of highlights how many I need to kill or we need to kill. So going to try to do that before the rut. I think it's best time to do it as early, unless you've got a bead on a big one you think you can kill. But it's important. It's just important. And I think people get lazy. I mean, to call out hunters. I mean, I've definitely have had times when I fall into the category of, I don't want to shoot a doe tonight because of this, but like, you only gonna have so many opportunities, and it is hunters. It's just hitting me on the head this year. It's like, you gotta shoot the does. It's our responsibility. Everybody wants to shoot a buck. Fine, whatever. But there's a lot of work that goes into it. And I think it just, people just turn away from it. They don't want to do it. You know, they got to go track it. They got to gut it. They got to, you know, everything, cut it up. But it's, we got to do it or it's going to lead to bigger problems.
Now, in your area, you're talking the fact that you have an abundance of does or just deer in general, probably, but does specifically. Now, have you started to do kind of calcs on what your buck to doe ratios are? Are those completely out of whack? I mean, a lot of areas like in Steuben County, some of the, you know, south of your farm, and I know you have a place down in Steuben, but south of your particular property, I hunted there for years in Allegheny, my family farms down that way, and just had, you know, the experience that there just was an overabundance of deer, you know, let alone the ratios were all skewed. And how does that play into like your decision-making, like on your big farm, the farm that you own and work on, how many does do you plan on shooting? Like, what's your objective? Have you set those? What are you thinking?
I usually just go by observation and just gut feel. I mean, in terms of numbers, if we killed, now you got to remember, I have a lot of acres, right? And it's a lot of it's farm acres. So I have incentive too to keep the doe numbers in check for crop damage. But I mean, I'm at the checkerboard, you know, it's not all together. So like I might have one farm where if I harvest one or two, I'm good. But then I may have like a 50 acre block, 60 acre block where I think we could harvest like 8 off and be good. So it's kind of hard to pin down a set number just because the farms are scattered all over the place. But I just think you get into the late season and it can get skewed because if you've got the only food source, you're drawing extra deer in and it may seem like you got a ton, but really they're just concentrated. But I think this time of year, you can really get a feel for it because pretty much they're all in their home areas, so to speak. And, you know, me as a farmer, I can assess with crop damage throughout the summer too. That's a big one for me. I go out and see where, I mean, we grow cabbage, so that's like the expensive crop. And when they eat that, it hurts a little more than when they eat the beans or corn or clover. It's no big deal. But so that type of observation is what I'm using.
All right, let's talk a little bit about your setups and, you know, any changes you've made this year to make you more productive, let's say, you know, middle of October, you know, that early rut period, end of October and into the rut. I know, you know, everyone's strategy is different. So I want to hear a little bit about, you know, your hopefulness for the season and the strategy that you're going to employ that time of year. And maybe we'll get into some more specifics, but let's talk about setups. Any things you've changed this year that you think are relevant that you want to share?
Well, you spoke of the box blind conversation that we had previous, and I have made some changes in that regard. And that is more related to brand of blind. And where we hunt in the hills down in Steuben County, the wind swirls constantly. And late season last year, I hunted out of two different style blinds. One is a Banks, one's a Redneck. And originally all I had was Redneck, but we got into these Banks. And last year we had numerous hunts where 20, 30 deer downwind in a Banks and they did not even lift their head up. Not the case with Rednecks. And I think it just comes down to their construction, seals, things like that, that just little things that when you're trying to stay undetected from, you know, the deer's nose, that make a difference. So that's one thing I've switched over to. I have a lot of luck. I added a blind on a trailer. So now I've got four portable blinds that I on a trailer. And those setups, it's, you know, that Bill Winky, quite frankly, when we worked with him, was the one that kind of opened my eyes to this. But when you got a wooded setting, a bedding area, and then it comes out to a big ag field, if you go in there and hunt on the edge of that timber, there's very, very, very low odds you're ever going to beat those deer's noses because they're going to come out into the field. And if your wind is blowing to the field, which makes sense, right? There's too many noses and eyes, and like especially if you're trying to hunt bucks. So what I do, and you know, somebody without a farm could do the same thing. If they've got a bigger food plot or whatever, you know, I put these blinds on the cart and the deer really don't mind them at all. I mean, some will react a little different, but the idea is to let the deer come out and feed to me. So I'll have those, say, you know, situation where the tree line, I don't have it like 60 yards from the tree line. Like that's too narrow of a gap. So I'll be like more like 100 depending on the situation, or maybe I got like a little jut out in the woods where it narrows it down. I can get a little tighter there. Just any way you can kind of funnel them in a big field, as crazy as that sounds, but to try to get them in bull range and then throw in the scent proofness of that blind. You know, you got to get out of there. I understand. So even hoping the deer feed off, or sometimes I can get a, you know, get somebody to spook them off with a car or something. But that's the October game for me in a lot of situations. I use those blinds a lot.
Well, this is interesting. If you would want to talk a little bit about, like, what's the trailer setup? How did you construct them? The elevation, those type of things. I'm interested to hear how you came up with your design, because I'm sure you put a lot of thought into it.
Well, I put a lot of thought into it, but I kind of used what I had. So I've got a, like, the most commercial thing is a Banks on skids. You can literally buy them right from Banks. Okay, that's the simplest one. You just pull it out of the four-wheeler. The other three I got range from a old auger, like a seed tender. It's got a sloped floor, and I cut part of the top off, put a floor in it, and put the blind on top of it. That's all it is.
I like that.
Steps to go up. Yeah, I mean, that's one. I just had that laying around. It wasn't getting used. I've got one on an old fertilizer tender. That's a new one I built. And that was just something, again, at the farm I had laying around. But a guy could go get that somewhere too. You know, you go to these farmers, you know, you drive around and see these things laying somewhere. I mean, it's not like they got to have real good tires or real good, you know, construction. You're not using them much. So you're just taking them to a field. So the fertilizer tender was the other one. That's pretty slick. I had to do a little, one of the guys in the shop did some welding and put a floor in there, but I got one on that. The height on that one is probably about 7 feet. The floor would be 7 feet. And again, that's just working with what I had. And then the last one is on a trail you'd put your ATV on. And it's just an old one. So that's probably only like 3 feet off the ground. I just put some posts down on that. So those are the four I have. They're all unique in their own way, but it's just using what you got.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, you know, the expense of some of the, I don't know what variety Perry Bat was telling me that they use, but those are, I think the trailers alone were like $15,000. I'm like, oh boy, that's, I know, jury's got some cash, but I mean, that's a little bit out of my price range. Building them or using, you know, what you can find around, but using like an old fertilizer tender, that's interesting. I mean, some of these like gravity wagons, all that stuff, you can kind of sneak up in the backside of them if you position them correctly. Maybe you can get in and out of those locations without having to do have a second come in and spook the deer off the field, et cetera. But it's just interesting. So you're actually placing these out into a field or in a location where the deer are eventually going to congregate or go through. Hopefully they're going to another area. But you're trying to using maybe terrain or just vegetation or something to kind of pinch them down to a certain point where, because I know you do a lot of bow hunting. So I'm assuming you're going to bow hunt out of these pretty consistently.
Yeah. Corn, standing corn in food plots. Like I've got several acres of corn, and I will also pull them in there. And then you're talking about the ultimate entry exit, because you go back through the corn. I'll take a handsaw and cut a walking trail right out the back in the standing corn. Have the mowed corn in front, or run it over, whatever you want to do. And that's probably one of my favorites, especially when it's close to bedding.
Sounds like an awesome setup. All right. When it comes to some of your other locations that you've set up, we've done some timber work and food plots. I want to talk a little bit about food plots in a second. Let's talk about, you know, how you've taken maybe some of the, and I don't know if this is more apparent to the farm or it's down on your other property, where you've taken an area and you've done some adjustment to it to get the deer flow a certain way. Maybe you've increased the bedding composition, maybe some, you know, description around some of those topics this year. Cause I know you've done a bunch of work.
Yeah. I just look at every setup, every farm that we have every year, and figure out how we can do something better. based on observation, based on success or lack of it. I really, really like, if you don't have a, I'll make a mock scrape and I'll doctor it up real nice. And there's, the more you do it, I think the better you get at realizing what's attractive, what the deer really like. So, you know, if you've got an area, whatever it is, a funnel, a staging area, whatever, I'm a big believer and user in the scrapes. And I've tried lots of different stuff in terms of branches, vines, ropes. I have not had good luck with a rope, like a synthetic rope. I've had good luck with vines. I just like using beech leaves. You can zip tie stuff down, tie it down, wire it down. Just, it's got to be visually appealing to the deer. You know, you got to get the height right and all that, and you know, work the ground up nice and soft, make it big, visually appealing. But that is just, I don't see any downside to that, other than going in and leaving your scent. But they just, I mean, they just, they get after it. They just work it. It just doesn't seem to matter. We've done a lot of work, not this year, but over the last three or four, with a mulcher, just making areas where, you know, deer will use those trails that you make. I've had instances here in New York, I'm sure you have too, where all the ash died, and it, which is great. It grows up, but it, in my situation here, it's grown up to like really invasive and things that deer aren't even walking through, not to mention the ash trees themselves blocking deer travel corridors. So that's something we've really had to watch for here and work with, where you get those ash trees.
If you could back up and talk a little bit about the scrape setup that you think at this point has been most productive, you know, maybe describe, you know, I this year I built, you know, I built the T-post setup this year, and I was, when I had the habitat day, somebody had asked me, wow, that's an interesting looking setup. And I said, it's the ultimate buck jungle gym. And they laughed, and I said, you know, I've been screwing around with a whole bunch of different stuff, and I just took, I think it's 3.5-inch pressure treated, you know, circular post, you know, and I just basically connected the two with some struts, and I built like a hanging system so I can just stick branches in and I don't have to worry about tying them in there. But, you know, the trick that I've learned, or the thing that I feel has worked well for me, is it has to be in a relative distance to a form of cover. And, you know, I've stuck them out in the fields, and I don't know if it's just the temperament of my deer, in the center of an area that's wide open, it's been completely unsuccessful. And those are probably my junior days. Now it's like, it's got to be a relative distance to a form of cover, or along a travel corridor to an area of cover. And it's got to be in cadence with their natural movement. And it's just finding that sweet spot where the deer is naturally either coming down that lane, or it's going to relate well to that object. And that's kind of been my tactic, whether it's 20 feet off, you know, a covered edge or a soft edge, or, you know, just a wooded edge, what have you, or it's, you know, it's a point out in a field that's connected to some, we'll say corn, for example. So it's got to have some relationship to cover. That's been one of my bits of success, I think. So I wanted you to describe your location for those, as well as, like, you know, how do you build, or what does it look like, kind of a T-post or whatever you want to call it, buck jungle gym scenario.
I think that T-post that you're speaking of, I think I have one almost identical to it. I saw you had that posted somewhere recently, I think.
Yeah, I did. Yep.
Yeah, I got something real similar. I was kind of lukewarm on those, to be honest, to start with. And I don't know if it was the actual, I just bought like a cedar post that they use like in grapes or something, right? Or fence post. The cedar post, put the 1x4 across the top, screwed it in, and then I get branches on each side. So it looks like a poor version of a tree. But initially the deer was just so with it. But as I've left that there for more years, this is probably year three, I think they're using it more than ever.
Yeah.
It's just so a staple. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Maybe it's like they don't want you sure at first. Like, that doesn't seem all quite natural. But over time, oh, yeah, that's there. And they seem to work it. So, and that one would be in a, I agree with you on the proximity to cover. You know, I see these videos in Iowa and whatnot, and they're going to these scrape trees out in the middle of a, you know, fairly good sized. And I can't think of a time where they've done that, because I've tried it too. I mean, I've tried it too, and you know, in a big ag field, it's tempting. I'll say, well, let's put this tree out there. It's the only tree in there. They'll come right to it. Well, it doesn't always work like that. So yeah, proximity to cover is important. And then, for me, it's just getting them distracted to draw your bow. You know, just having them where they're not on edge. I've had too many deer over the years just that duck and get out, you know, make either the shot marginal or it doesn't even get them. And my daughter's hunting now and she's got slow, you know, she's only like 40 some pounds. So that arrow takes a long time to get there. So it's just something where you don't have to, you know, if they're on that trail and they go to the scrape and work it, they're naturally preoccupied. And I don't think they're near as likely to drop when you shoot.
One of the, don't agree with you 100% on everything that you're suggesting. One thing that I did change and it's worked well for me is, and I'm always hounding, finding T posts for a whole host of projects, mostly for tree projects. Well, I've been like stacking T posts all over the place. Well, I'm tired. I hate the concept of having to dig a hole and putting, you know, a big 6x6 or even a 4x4 post in the ground. And, you know, now I'm putting T posts everywhere. And then I've got T posts almost like these scrape jungle gyms are portable. And on the back of them, I have like a metal strap. And so I've got three metal straps or two metal straps, and I can just take the T-post off, almost like a Jesus cross, take it off and put it on the next T-post in an adjacent area. Now, I'm not doing that, but if I wanted the option to do that, it's great, especially when I'm doing crops. So if I'm planting an area, I can leave that T-post or I can remove the T-post, and I can easily take on and off because I've got the strap holding that T on, or excuse me, holding that the bottom 3.5 inch, you know, vertical, cylindrical post, treated post. It's just basically a strap to the T post. And so I can slide it on and off, and it works really simply for me. And it just gives me that ability to kind of move that on and off in a particular area. But I like the concept of trying to leave those in there as much as possible, just so they become more, you know, more consistent use feature on the landscape.
How often do you think you need to say you've got a limb that's not, it's going to die. It's not connected to, you know, a tree anymore. You're going to put it on your setup there, your T post or whatever. How often do you, or whether maybe it's a vine, how often do you feel like you need to freshen them up? Twice. Meaning that a new branch.
I do it twice a year. That's been pretty much twice a year. The rope that I've added to those, that hemp rope that I basically weathered and it's been sitting out all summer, and you know, I don't have any foreign object. I use the rope to rewrap around just to create that kind of, you know, tethered edge, or I don't know what the term is, but basically frilled edge. I'm not a fan of those. I'll just say that straight up. I know a lot of guys are. I'm not. But I'm doing that just to show everybody that doesn't work. I'm still doing it. And I'm not saying a deer won't use it. And that's just, I'm not going to say, because they've already been using that, but they, more times than not, they're going to go to that branch. And that's what I found. And that seems to be consistent to me. And I don't put any, I'm not using any attractant in my particular areas. And no folks are, and maybe that's a question for you. Do you use attractant? Have you found things that you feel work and that would help?
I do. I use buck fever.
Sure.
Especially the forehead stuff. And I'll like, just because I've seen how attracted they are to it. And once they start using it, then it's just game over, because it just leaves the scent. But you know, whether it's a does hit it first or sometimes bucks, but I'll squirt that stuff way up in the trees, like high, just to be like it's like burning a can, you know, it's like trying to make the whole area just smell like that. So they come in, and then obviously, you know, they'll be up on their back legs trying to get up as high as I've sprayed. It's crazy.
Wow.
So I don't know what it is, but that's the only one that I've really used, you know, in my situations. On the rope thing quick, last year I had a rope out. I had a trail camera on video mode, and I had a rope side with a maple tree. It was in a limb, a natural one. And it was very clear. I mean, I'm talking 90% of the deer went to the branch and didn't touch the rope. In fact, a lot of them would give that weird look to the rope, like, that's a little bit weird. I don't want to say it scared them off, but they were definitely cautious of it. And I had that rope sitting out outside a long time before I put it out there.
I was just going online looking at the buck fever synthetics that a lot of people are using. I know, you know, obviously we both know the gentleman that runs that business, but I've not used that product. And the more and more guys that I talk to, they love the product. They love that particular product. It's got me pretty interested. Mm-hmm. So those that are using it, I'm interested to hear what you find.
Yeah. So a word of advice. I buy my own bottle, like a round, I don't know what they'd be, maybe 12 ounce, 8 ounce squirt bottle. You can get them at the, you know, Runnings or something, whatever. And, I'll dump the buck fever into that because those squirters on the buck fever are, I don't know what it is. They're not very good. So word of advice there, buy your own thing and your bottle and dump it in there and then just use it pretty liberal. And again, if you buy one of them, just buy the forehead one. I think it's blue. I think it's a blue label. Yep, is the one you want.
Yep. I'm online. It's a blue label right now. You got me interested. All right. I'll give it a shot. That's not been my mode of operation, but I'm always interested in new stuff. All right, let's talk a little bit about your setup specifically, and I want to drill into an area where you've done some work. I want you to talk about the work that you've done specifically in a setup that you think is going to be highly successful during this mid-October, you know, late October, early rut period, and just maybe dialogue a little bit about, you know, the history in that location and what you've done to enhance it where, you know, you're going to kill one of these other giant bucks like you've done year in and year out. Let's talk about that.
I'm trying to pick one that would be, I've got a few, and I kind of the one that I probably will rarely hunt it, but I'm probably the most excited about it is down in Steuben County. And, we own like basically a side of a hill that runs up to the high point, and then there's a property on the backside before the next road. And, I'm more of a flatland hunter. I mean, full disclosure, I just haven't done the hill thing much and trying to get to the thermals and all this stuff. But just finally, we went up winter scouting up there this year and we found just this hub of scrapes, like 5-6 scrapes within like a 10-20 yard area. And it's like, anytime you see that, you know, you get interested. Like, why is this happening? How can we hunt it? Whatever. And traditionally I just left that area alone. I just didn't hunt it. But I went over and talked to the neighbor on the other road and he's good with letting me access it. And we're going to come down and it's just, you know, you're going to play those morning thermals. He may not even go in there totally at dark. He might wait till the thermals start rising. It, you know, if you're talking strictly wind, it is good for a last wind, but if you throw the thermals in with it, that's neat just because I haven't hunted that setting much at all. I mean, it's what I would call for this area. It's, you know, it's deep into the timber and it should be good action starting, you know, about mid-October right on through mid-November. I can't get cell coverage up there, so I've got a SD cam working, but there's been a couple nice bucks on it. I just checked it this weekend. So that's probably got me the most excited. And again, that's just like being, I guess, I don't want to say I was lazy before, but like, you know, it's way more work to get there.
Yeah.
But it's just a matter of doing it because I don't think there's going to be, I saw one other stand up in that general area, but I'm not worried about it. I think it's just going to be a good spot. And personally, it's probably just a personal problem. The reason with those hills is because I'm just like, picture me in a box blind. That's me. I want to be somewhere where I feel like bulletproof. They're not going to smell me. You know what I mean? And I go up on those hills and the wind swirls and it drives me crazy. It's just a mental thing for me, but I'll get over it. And so I'm excited about that one just because it's different for me. Go ahead if you got something.
No, I think it's great. I think I went through that a similar phase to you where, you know, all my hunting was, you know, pretty much trudging in and pushing the limits. And then I went to this really conservative mindset. And then last year I went back to going after it again. And it was like a reawakening. It kind of brought me back to the days when I was a kid, just kind of bouncing around. And then we have this debate, you know, we were talking about the insanity list. So my partner and a good friend of mine, Mark Cobb, who's been on this podcast, we chat every day, like, you know, just sending pictures around like you probably do with your buddies. And we're just chatting. And I'm like, you know, I got so much money in box blinds. And Josh goes, that's insane. Like, as do you. That's insane. And I love the bulletproofness aspect of those particular situations. But then you lose a little bit, too. You lose some of the, you know, the freedom you have just being in a stand or doing hanging hunts. So I can appreciate your mindset. All right. Why don't you go to another spot that you're thinking about?
Yeah, just a quick side note too. And having that spot I talked about up in the hills, the coolest thing ever, which I've also lost a little bit of connection with, is pulling them SD cards. That's like, I forgot what that was like. I mean, cell cameras are fine; it's great, but like, man, that was SD card. That's like Christmas morning. That's the best. That's exciting. You know, you sit down at the end of the day and you put. I had like four or five of them up in there with no cell coverage. It was great. It was awesome. So.
One thing this morning. So when I was pulling, I do test spots. So this is, I think an area is really good. I'm like, oh, definitely, you know, I've seen deer move through here and I'm like, I'm hesitant to commit a cell camera to that spot knowing, you know, I'm not going to go back there and move it. So I'm putting, you know, soaker cameras or non-cell cameras in those particular areas. Well, I had a chance today to go in those two areas and check them. And one was a dud and two were good. And I'm sitting there and say, okay, well, I've got kind of some test case data. So I'm almost using the trail camera to be a test case before I put a cell in there. That's kind of I know, you know, your circumstance is different, but I found many times I definitely know where to put this camera. And I've had to do a little bit of like, abbreviation of trying to figure out what the right angle to put the camera at so I can get, you know, the deer collective that goes through there. And I know that I'm making mistakes with my camera set up sometimes. And it takes me a couple of years to like really dial it in. Usually a year after the next year, I figure out what I screwed up on, and it happens to everybody. So.
Yeah. There's always those spots where like you go back and you put it on the exact same tree just because it was perfect. And then I'd say, I don't know what percent, maybe half or less, I maybe tweak it a little bit, you know, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse.
Right.
And that's just height or angle or whatever, you know? So yeah, like another setup, let's go to like more of a flatter land farm country setup. That would have to be, I can think of a spot, in October. The beauty of October is each day that goes by, those bucks, as you know, are more likely, they get on their feet sooner. I mean, it's not like a perfect science, but, you know, throwing weather, cold fronts, whatever, that adds to it. But like every day on the calendar that goes by, I tell the guys I hunt with, I'm like, it's getting closer and closer. And to me, the prime, if I had to pick a single time to hunt, probably be a toss up between late season, but I prefer that late October in the 20s just because more deer are alive than the late season. But you know, so October, a mature buck isn't going to move a lot in daylight on the afternoons. I'm hunting mainly afternoons, very rarely mornings until somewhere in the 20s of October. And that's probably a subject for another day, but they're not going to move far. So I've had a couple setups where, you know, back to your point a little bit of being the conservative versus more aggressive. And I think there's a happy medium there. And I think as we get older and we'll continue to learn, we'll have to say, I have this podcast when we're in our 60s and we'll have probably a different story. But, you know, I think that those mature bucks, there's those setups, these are tree stand setups where if at all possible, I'm going to hang one preseason. I'm not going to try to hang and hunt because of how close you'd sometimes got to get to these things. And in my situation, I've usually got a camera guy too, and that's just double. So to try to go in and hang and hunt, I won't, but I've got a couple this year that are just that much closer to really, really, really good bedding. I got this one. I actually got to go back today and finish it, but the only way to get in and out of this tree was through a flooded area. And it was only a 100 yards from the field edge, maybe, but it was like through some nasty, I don't even know what the stuff was, but it was growing in standing water, thick. And that water was over, I mean, it was over your knees. So it's like, I don't really want to wear hip waders, get to the tree, because you're tight to the bedding. So it was dry this summer, so dry. And I was able to get a couple different times, I'd go in with a backhoe and clear a path through this. Well, now it's bone dry, but I want to be prepared when it's normally flooded. And I'm going to go down today with a chainsaw and cut down, I guess, some dead ash around the area. And I'm going to take the backhoe, get those logs in there while it's dry, where when it gets wet again, because we all know it will, I'll be able to stand on top of them logs and get that distance from the field edge almost to the base of that tree and right up. And I'm in like prime bedding, some of the best bedding I got. So if you can make those entry exits as good as you can, and sometimes it's unorthodox. In this situation, this would definitely be one of the most unorthodox. But, you know, if you got the equipment and resources, or if you got money to pay somebody to do it, if you feel that good about it, and I do on this one, that's why I'm putting the effort in.
Oh, wow. It's a lot of work to get access into these areas clean, and I applaud you. So what time of year are you going to hunt that spot? So tell me your strategy specifically for that location.
That's going to definitely be in October, probably. I don't think it's going to be early October. It's going to be mid to late and end of November. It's just like a, I mean, how big it is, maybe 20 acres, 15 maybe, but it's isolated, which makes it's surrounded by ag, which I love those situations, instead of right up next to property boundaries and stuff. So this one's isolated, and it's just, we logged it super heavy. This is a funny story. This is probably 10 years ago. The logger misunderstood me, and he thought that we were going to clear some of it for farmland, and that was not the case. So he hit it like extra hard. Well, at the time, I didn't really, you know, I was thinking it was no big deal, whatever. And well, now it's just turned into, it's just one of them spots where between the head high grasses, I'm actually worried in this spot about getting shot early, to be honest with you, just because the stuff they're traveling through is just, you know, it's head high in spots, but it's got the box elders throughout it. It's just bucky. You know what I mean? It's just bucky, swampy in spots. So yeah, that's going to be a mid to late October deal. And yeah, it's exciting. I'm hoping that putting these logs down, the deer won't use that trail either going in and out. Cause right now I bet you they are, because it's dry and I've got it opened up like a backhoe width. But I think if I put these logs in there, I don't think they're going to use it. And that's even better. That way it's, you know, because anytime you can walk when the deer are going to come after night and smell where you went, you know the deal.
Yeah. But when you say you put logs in, is it kind of like building a bridge all the way down a corridor? What's that? What's that like?
So just picture like a backhoe width, say 80 yards length. Okay. And then it's in an area that traditionally the water's so high. So I'm just trying to figure out, the first thing I tried to do, you'll laugh at this. I had some cinder block from I think it was some construction project we did. So I told him, dump it over here. Well, I went down there this summer one day. It was, you know, hot and everything, bugs. And I want to go out in that water. I'm going to lay these cinder blocks down. Well, the problem was all those roots and stuff from those trees that I cut out of there, they wouldn't lay flat and level. So that was shot. So I'm just thinking, cut these big logs down, cut the tops off them and then it'll be flat. And I'm just going to use the gripper on the back of the hoe on the backhoe and just set them in there lengthwise. Probably got to go two rows just so you're stable.
Yep.
I got room for it.
Yep.
And then when it gets wet again, I don't care if the water is up to your ankles or, you know, part way up your calf, but like, you know, I can't deal with it when it's, when it's over. Yeah. I just, you know what I mean? And well, it's going to be clumsy.
It's gonna be, yeah, loud. You're going to be clumsy and loud and you're going to be cold. Yeah. I mean, it's just, yeah, it's a combination. Yeah. I'm with you. So you brought up another point. You said late season is one of your favorite or one of your favorite periods. And I think that has to be related to food. And I'm kind of wondering what your setups are for late season. What are your preferred food sources? Any strategy to laying those out that works well to some of your key spots? Can you maybe drill a little bit into what that looks like?
Yeah. I have gotten away from soybeans. And that goes back to our original one of our original conversations in this podcast about doe numbers. And if I planted 5 acres of soybeans, we had a lot of prevented planting this year on the farm. So I was like salivating because I've almost got like a blank slate in some of these fields. They're not getting farmed, so I can go in and put food plots. I put 5 acres of soybeans. Okay. Now, granted, we had the drought. They are, if you look across them with a light, I'm sure you've seen it before. It's just stems sticking up. I don't know if I'm going to have any beans. So to me, for the deer, especially when you got the high numbers, go with corn. If between corn and beans, definitely go corn. And then you've got that added benefit of the structure of the corn, which is, like I told you before, one of my favorite things is to enter through the standing corn into some harvested corn or into some mowed corn and then right into a box blind or some, whatever it may be. So the corn is number one. I definitely like to mix in some brassica as well. I find they like the brassica better in the southern tier than they do in farm country in Ontario County. I think they got too many options in farm country versus Steuben.
I'd agree.
I've also, this year, somewhat by default, I'm getting into planting the brassica later because at the end of the year, they don't hardly eat many of those bulbs.
Yeah, everybody talking about tonnage. I want the tonnage with the bulbs.
Sure, that's tonnage, but the deer, they won't. They don't eat them. They'll eat whatever's exposed, a couple bites off them, but they're eating the tops. So if I can make those tops green and tender and maybe younger during season, I think that's going to be the way to go versus giant tops with big bulbs, but maybe those tops aren't so attractive to them.
Yeah. Yeah. It's similar strategy. I do something very similar in my particular area. And then I hit them with a chemical compound here about this week. And it doesn't sweeten them up. It just adds to the nutrient density of the particular plant as it's kind of going in that middle stage of development. So you're planting late and then you hit it with a nutrient flush, which I don't really want to mention on this podcast because I haven't really exposed all the little secrets that I do, but I'm telling you, I can get those deer hitting those radish tops or brassica, left and right. And I'm not too worried about the bulbs, like to your point. And yeah, they will consume it and it's maybe part of their diet at some point throughout the year. But the reality of it is most times, me particularly using like a radish as an example, is I'm just hopeful that it aerates the ground and it kind of utilizes some of the nitrogen that's in that area and exposes some of the nitrogen for the next crop that's usually have covers in and around those, adjacent. So I don't have a lot of blank spaces and that's a big part of the design.
Okay.
I've got one more question for you. So I'm really interested in the Steuben County property just because it sounds like, it's I know that's traditionally been a pretty productive area, although I think you killed your really big buck last year on the home farm or in that area, if I'm correct.
The last two bucks I've killed have been on that farm, yep.
Yeah. Yep. The Steuben County property that you have, do you deal with much pressure down there? And are people focused on the same things you are? And have you had to combat like different mindsets when it comes to quality deer, older age class deer, et cetera? Just interested more on just your mental philosophy and what you're working with or against in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. So if you're comparing the farmland to down there in Steuben County, the deer just naturally have a higher survival rate, I find down there. And that's just because there's more places to hide and it's less accessible. This farmland's tough. Like I had guys come here from New Hampshire when they do the Doe Fest. And they're hunting, big woods in New Hampshire. And their comments, more than one of them, was like, I don't know how these deer survive. Like, it's just too it's too yep. accessible. Yep. And then you give guys rifles. And, it's like the great equalizer, as I call it. And, I don't know how they survive. So, like, Steuben County, more timber, naturally they have – they're going to survive. The survival rate is, over the years, is higher down there for bucks. The people part has evolved. It definitely has evolved. The number of gunshots that I hear is way less than it was 10, 15 years ago. So that part's down. I think it gets to the fact of, less hunters probably. Those little deer camps, I can think of a couple of them around me. It used to be pretty just brown it down opening day, and they're either sold or they've got way less people and they don't come very often. So it has improved. I can think of neighbors, new neighbors that have come in and they've reached out to me. Like they'll see my switchgrass and they'll come track me down or find me or get my number somehow. And they're very like-minded. So, it only takes a little bit. I mean, you get maybe some of the worst, quote unquote, worst out of there, replace them with some, like-minded people. And, your neighborhood's going to improve. It's definitely going to improve.
It's interesting you talk about the difference between the two areas and how, you've had to adapt to either one. It's almost a good thing that you have those particular kind of landscape variations. It gives you a different perspective, but I'm always intrigued, right? My family's from Allegheny County, so I'm always intrigued in going back down there hunt. And then I come to my area where the deer population is pretty low and the hunting's not that great comparably. The numbers themselves are just generally lower, and the quality of deer itself over time, we've just polluted these particular areas with bad business decisions. I like to say is we're not really promoting the good. We're taking the good out and we're leaving the bad. So the bad, when I'm talking about bad, I'm talking about low quality deer with smaller antlers. And so we've just kind of procreated the worst scenario you could be in from a quality standpoint. But what I do appreciate the fact is I have seen some folks around me start to think a little bit differently. And I guess the question is this. You have a fairly big following. The YouTube channel gets a lot of viewers, and in that, is there pressure for you to be successful every single year? And in that, because you got to make content. In that, how do you approach that just from a business mindset? How do you stay the course? I know you hunt with probably some of your buddies, and you obviously have your daughter out there with you now. How you've kind of taken that in stride and been okay and comfortable knowing that you've got to find some level of success, but you also have to balance the opportunities and you've got to put yourself in the right situation. I think it's created a lot of prep work for you. And there's probably a lot of time you spend now just planning ahead that you may have not had 2 years ago. And so I just want to hear a little bit about that to kind of finish off the podcast.
Yeah, that's good stuff. I guess I'm at a point in my life. I mean, I'm 44 and I really honestly don't care if people think I know a dang thing about deer. Like, I don't really care. Like I do it because I enjoy it. I enjoy the people aspect of it. Throw in my kids, becoming a factor, and that's awesome as well, having them. So, but I'm just like over, sure, I want to kill one every year. Yes, it is. But like, if I don't, I'd rather shoot some does and know that I'm doing better. I'm doing good for the herd by managing that aspect. If I don't kill a big buck, it is what it is. I don't care. Like, I don't know. I'm getting to that point where whatever stage of deer hunting that's at, it's where I'm at. And I'll go to the lengths now where I'm trying to make it as hard as I can on myself. To kill a buck, so like it just brings me that much more satisfaction by making it hard. We got enough guys on the team that travel way more than I do. We'll get content. It's okay. I mean, is there a little pressure? Yeah, but I'm just in it for the camaraderie and help guys out. It's real good friends, and I enjoy the business aspect of it. But in my point in my life, I mean, I'm thankful for this. I really doesn't like, I don't feel that pressure all the time. It's just, I'm over it,
Yeah, no, that's good. I appreciate that bit of information. Cause I think a lot of people kind of wonder, these guys on TV, they have got to make things happen. And, I would assume that makes some pressure. Josh and I talked about this yesterday and I told them, sometimes I feel pressure because I need to kill a big buck to increase, business opportunities for me. And then part of it's like, Not really. And the way I've approached it was I'm just having fun, and you know, I don't have to shoot. I'm not expecting myself to be successful all the time. I'm expecting myself to have fun. And, you know, that's kind of where I'm at in my journey. And to your point earlier, I really think, you know, a part of this, and it might be an age thing, cause we're right around the same age. Part of this is just coming into the kind of a pace of life that you're comfortable more so with what you have and what you know, and what you don't know as well. And not being too, I guess, opinionated on certain topics, and just being open to learning. And, certainly you're in that mindset.
Yeah.
Eric, anything else you want to leave the audience with that you think it would be important for them to consider this season, late season, just any time this year to maybe add to their success? Anything you're doing different, thinking different about, or just approaching that might be, you know, relevant to folks?
Yeah, I'd say just don't be afraid to take a calculated risk. I think it's like maybe you've been in the same boat as me over the years, playing a little too cautious. You know your area. Know the deer's personality and know the time of year and when you can get away with a mistake more than others. Just don't be, you only get a few weeks each season of this glory time, you know, like this awesome time we all live for. It's only a few weeks. You don't get them back. And the deer are going to be the deer. Like when it comes to December, they're going to be chill and they're going to be back on food. And you know, you got this October period where they're just ramping up every day, but take advantage of those days, you know. And that being said, don't get so caught up in the perfect day to hunt. Like we all have lives and we're busy as heck. You got kids, it's even busier, businesses. All this data is great on when the high odds days are to go out. But for me, it just boils down to going when you can go. If I can go, I'm going to go. Now, if it's a 0 mile an hour wind and 75 degrees, then I'm not going to do it. But like, you just got to go when you have time and don't take don't take yourself too seriously. I find myself getting grumpy. This is probably what I do need to work on, is I get grumpy during the year because like I want to be out there, and if things aren't cooperating or I'm not getting the chances, I'll get a little grumpy. But at the end of the day, you know, if I don't get one, but I do definitely want to focus on that doe harvest. If you got areas that need it, you got to get after it, because it's going to lead to things that we don't want as hunters. Overpopulation, you're going to get, you know, whether it's something as crazy as more predators introduced, or maybe it's having sharpshooters in areas of killing deer. It's going to get to a place where it's not good. So know your area. Maybe you don't need to shoot does in your area, but, try to just be educated about everything and think of the bigger picture, because we've got that responsibility as hunters.
Awesome. Eric, thanks for ending with that. I think that was a good remark for everyone to think about. Appreciate you taking time out of your day for me and participating in the podcast. And I'm looking forward to see how the season goes for you. And hopefully all your dreams come true. I hope your daughter has a successful season. So,
yeah, you too. Always a pleasure. Anytime. I'm sure we'll be talking.
All right. Talk soon. See ya.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.
Where's your playlist taking you? Down the highway? To the mountains? Or just into daydream mode while you're stuck in traffic? With over 4,000 hotels worldwide, Best Western is there to help you make the most of your getaway, wherever that is. Because the only thing better than a great playlist is a great trip. Life's the trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
USAA knows dynamic duos can save the day, like superheroes and sidekicks, or auto and home insurance. With USAA, you can bundle your auto and home and save up to 10%. Tap the banner to learn more and get a quote at usaa.com/bundle. Restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Peloton. Break through the busiest time of year with the brand new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus. Powered by Peloton IQ. With real-time guidance and endless ways to move, you can personalize your workouts and train with confidence, helping you reach your goals in less time. Let yourself run, lift, sculpt, push, and go. Explore the new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus at onepeloton.com.
Residence Day savings are happening now at the Home Depot with up to 40% off select appliances. Looking to upgrade your fridge? Check out LG's newest model, serving up ice in all kinds of styles. Cube, crushed, craft ice, and now new mini craft ice straight from the dispenser. From cold brew to fizzy favorites, these refrigerators will have you entertaining like a pro. Shop President's Day savings and get up to 40% off, plus free delivery on select appliances like LG at the Home Depot. Free delivery on appliance purchases of $1,498 or more. Offer valid February 5th through the 25th, U.S. only. See store online for details.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.